Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.
My name's Jerry Pives, and right in front of me, I've got my wonderful guest, Christine Carter. Welcome, Christine, to Real People.
Yes, I like it.
So, Christine, you've agreed to sit in the psychotherapist chair for the next hour. Why on earth would you do that?
Well, actually, now I'm starting to question myself, but no. Well, once again, I'm a pretty open book. I've never really ever in my life been too worried about what people think of me. In fact, sometimes I've been accused of being a little bit too blunt. But yeah, for me, it's more what I get the understanding of. It's the opportunity for people to hear about, yeah, my philosophy of how I feel life is magic and how it can be magic for people.
Well, that's wonderful. And of particular interest to me and, of course, to the listeners will be to delve into a little bit of your life and also to have as a backdrop to this conversation how you manage to deal with stress and trauma, because we're all struggling. Well, we're not all struggling, but sometimes we all struggle at some point or another. And this program is pretty much dedicated to hearing from folk and what their down-to-earth practical tools are for managing stress and trauma. That's one of the reasons for this show as well. And also to explore a little bit what makes you tick, really, what gets you out of bed in the morning.
Well, I kind of joke about that quite often. What gets me out of bed in the morning is I use my Bioptron light every day. And that kind of is a way of making sure that everything's wired correctly. And yeah, I find that light really helps. And I know, you know, even before we got into working with Bioptron, I've always used white light to be something to kind of make sure that my auric field is feeling good. And when we were traveling, we used it as our protection all the time. And so, yeah, it's just a way to get the day started. I don't even call it a meditation. It's just a general focus for bringing the light in.
Lovely. What a lovely image. We're going to probably come back to that, I suspect, later on in the chat. But just to begin with, how old are you, Christine?
I'm 67 this year. Yeah, so starting to creep very close to the 70 and thinking, oh my gosh, that actually sounds old, which is quite a shock when you get to this age, yeah. But also delighted.
And give me, in a couple of minutes, could you give the listeners a thumbnail sketch of your whole life?
Wow, okay. Yeah, I was born in Whakatane. And I actually believe that was quite a privilege in the sense that geographically, the way I used to explain it when I was overseas, is we're at the bottom of the world in the basket of the Bay of Plenty. And I just happened to be born right where all of that abundance has grown. That was my little statement. And it was very interesting because I've now heard some Maori legends based on what that's all about. And maybe we can talk about that later. But yeah, brought up in a family, business family. So brought up with very much mum and dad talking about the business, educated in a way that kind of got me thinking about how to be that entrepreneurial type person that just makes things happen. And then had a big dream to travel. My father had been in Rotary, and so we had every few months, we would have an exchange person from overseas coming and living in our house for a few months. And they came from all parts of the world. And so for me, my big dream was to travel. And then at 17, I ended up getting pregnant the first time I had sex and ended up with twins. One of those kind of, you know, freak things that sort of happened, but completely changed the course of my life, obviously. And at that point, I said, right, the day they turn 18, I'm leaving home and I'm going to travel then. And that's literally kind of what happened. In the time that they were growing up, I had a number of businesses, but mainly worked for myself because I learned very quickly that I'm unemployable, mainly because I figured that I know which way to do it. And then the time when they turned 18, they'd actually left home at 17, mainly because I paid them to leave. At that stage, they're at Auckland Grammar. And I don't know what it's like for anybody else with teenage boys, but I used to have them all around at my place for the parties. And in the end, one day I went, I've had enough of this. If I pay for you guys to leave and in an apartment, will you go? And then I don't have to put up with all of this mess around that they would leave. And so it was, yeah, it was a kind of a funny thing. All the other mothers were horrified because now they had this apartment in the city. They were going to Auckland Grammar, but they had an apartment in the city. And so the parties were really big then. But it was great because we then able to have this relationship just before I left to go overseas. And that's when we decided to head off overseas. And it was sort of initially just going to be a little OE because both my partner at the time and my husband now, we hadn't travelled when we were younger like a lot of people do. And so we decided we're going to have a little OE and we'll then you know, come back and kind of start our life again. Well, 14 years later, after we arrived in the United States, actually on the 4th of July, and they put this huge big celebration on for us with lots of fireworks and all sorts of goody stuff. And we then proceeded to purchase a motorhome thinking, oh, we'll just have 10 months in the States and then we'll head on to Europe and then come home. At the 10-month time, we threw the ticket away onto Europe and continued our journey. 14 years later, at the bottom of South America, it was time, Sam decided it was time to come home. I was kind of kicking and screaming at that point. But now in having a look at my, the way the journey kind of happened is, yes, that was the timing for me to come back because that was my Chiron return. And so it was very significant in the end coming back home and reconnecting with the traditional roots here of New Zealand, Māori connections, but as well as that, discovering the Bioptron Light and becoming divisional managers for Bioptron here in New Zealand, which has enabled us to continue travelling. So we're still in a motorhome up until just recently.
Just to be clear, just I've got this picture. You, from when your twins got to 18 years old, what was your age when you started your journey?
About 34, 35, somewhere around there.
So for the last 30 years, you've been a vagrant, yes?
Yes, totally. And even Facebook just doesn't get that you've got this different situation all the time, you know, like it, yeah, really bamboozles them. Yeah.
Wonderful. And you were recommended, I'm not going to say who recommended you, but someone recommended you for this show for me to interview, because I never interview people who recommend themselves. And why do you think that, have you any idea why they might have recommended you for this show?
Actually, it was quite funny because he phoned me up and he said, oh, I think I've done something wrong. I go, oh, Mike, you know, what's that? And he goes, well, I've actually put your name forward for RCR. Hope you don't mind. And I go, well, that's interesting. Why did you do that, Mike? And he goes, well, do you know, I've been watching you. And he said, you know, you've driven me nuts because you keep telling me that I've got to stop focusing on all the negative things that are happening and I've got to be more positive. And I never kind of really got that. But I think I've now got what you're talking about, because what I see in you is that you just get out there and do the things that you need to do, but you're not talking about it or moaning about it, and you just get in and make things happen. And he used a couple of examples, like I'm involved in the local gardening group here, which sort of formulated out of us looking at, you know, where are our resources in our community. But more importantly for me, I'm involved in organising it because I need to learn about gardening, because we now have a garden I haven't had for 30 years. So yeah, there's lots of those sorts of things that have come out of it. And then he was also part of helping me with the Sue Gray's campaign here on the West Coast. And I'd sworn off politics back when I was 20, but I just got totally inspired by the fact that I knew she was going to be able to make a difference for us here, just in a very minute way. All she promised was that she would actually be in Parliament to receive the petitions that came in, and that she would then be able to get all of the documentation for her IOAs quickly. And I thought, right, that's the kind of woman I want. I don't want all these promises of things that people are not going to fulfil. I got on my motorhome and travelled with her and got to know our West Coast really well because of that. So
the listeners might be interested to know, actually, that they can go back to replays and hear my interview with Sue Gray, which was a lovely interview, and it was really lovely to learn about her past and her life. So, listeners, you can go back to that. And just in case you're wondering what you are listening to, you're listening to RCR, which I suspect you might know. My name's Jerry Pives, and this is Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. And I'm talking to Christine Carter. And really, you seem to have manifested from the age of 34 onwards a true wandering soul, a traveling gypsy spirit.
Yes. Yes. In fact, I am proud of that. I really believe that there are a lot of us are not meant to be in one place, but we're being conditioned to be. And
yes,
for me, both my husband and I definitely have that in us. And we love variety. You know, I'd get bored in one set place.
And I think, if I remember correctly, when we come back and do our music later on, you have a piece of music that whenever you set off on your next journey, you would play. It was On the Road Again, I think it was.
Yes. Willie Nelson kind of inspired us when we first started on the journey, like when we purchased the motorhome, which was a big thing. And when we went to the States, we had this big long list of things we were going to have, you know. And it was hilarious because every one of them got changed through. Luckily, we had a very good salesperson who sat us down. And initially, we were looking at this tiny little, they call them a dolphin. They're sort of on the back of a Toyota truck with a little cab over thing. And so he stuck us inside there. And then he took us to this other bigger motorhome. And he said, now I want you to visualize you having an argument. And all of a sudden, the bigger motorhome made a lot of sense. And, you know, we're both Aries. So, of course, we're going to have arguments. And so that's how we discovered Izzy. And Izzy was our partner in crime in our 14-year journey through the Americas. And she was a Winnebago with a 454 Chevy motor. And she guzzled gas like you wouldn't believe and looked like a real mess on the outside, which is great because it didn't look like we were abundant. She was 14 years old. So when we sold her, she was 28 years old. And it was like, I think she really wanted a journey. She'd been going from San Francisco to Tahoe for a 3-week holiday every year. And that's all she'd done. And she was so happy to be on the road. And she took us on lots of adventures. Yeah.
The listeners might like to know that there's an absolutely amazing account of your travels on your website. Where do they go on their website to find you, Christine? If they want to read your, I'm sure we'll hear some of it today, but if they want to hear in more detail with wonderful photographs of your travels, how do they find you?
I think it's on our story or something about us or whatever. I can't remember.
Yes.
Itself, but yes, we had, because we felt that was an integral part of who we are, is because of that journey we got to explore many different philosophies, like things like our motorhome sometimes telling us what was going on with us. We didn't need to go to therapy because all of a sudden she would have brake issues, which meant that we were going a little bit too fast, or she would overheat, which meant we were overheating. Every time she kind of told us exactly what was going on with us. And I know that might sound weird, but it was true. And she also broke down in places that we were meant to meet these amazing people. One time it was outside an angel shop in Tucson. And we ended up connecting with some people that then got us to do a workshop for them while we were there. And out of that workshop came enough money to be able to pay for a ticket home. So just weird stuff like that.
Well, you're talking about a very profound concept, really. I mean, on the one hand, it could be seen as, you know, you're forming some kind of symbiosis with a bit of metal and wheels and an engine, which could be regarded as odd. But on the other hand, you could also look at it in terms of some of the philosophies around synchronicity that, for example, Carl Jung wrote about this a great deal, that there is this kind of, there's a coherence. And in quantum theories now, we do have theories that actually make you not quite as wacky as you might sound to some people.
No, I know. This is what we discovered for ourselves without the science behind it. It was literally so much of it. And I now see it in relationship to, like, for many years I taught and studied the Mayan calendar. That was sort of in my journey while we were overseas. And then since then, when I got home, got involved with human design. And when we look into both of those different philosophies and looking at them, how everything kind of lines up from the planetary lineup that's going on is actually there's these neutrinos coming down, bringing information to us all the time. And when we're, and this is what I've learned about human design, when I'm sitting in the back seat, really stopping my mind from wanting to control my life, it's amazing how much magic happens, how much synchronicity falls into place, because actually I'm just falling into place with the planetary lineup and the planetary lineup of all those others that are around me, and then magic kind of just happens.
It was lovely to have such a description of your life, I mean, in a very shortened version, obviously, but we're now talking about some very interesting or profound issues. You're talking about an idea that is at the center of many different philosophies and approaches, which is this idea that when we are, as it were, following the path that is our path, that we're meant to be following, life kind of comes up behind us and supports us, right? And when we're going against our truth, if we talk about our personal truth, when we're going against it, we hit a lot of roadblocks. I think all the listeners will probably relate to that concept. Whatever language we might use for that, this idea that we have a purpose and we have a way that is our way.
Yeah.
And if we hear that, then life kind of flows rather beautifully. It sounds like your life flowed beautifully, that story of breaking down and then getting a workshop and then having enough money to do what you wanted to do, which was to get back. It's a beautiful little story.
Yeah, and those can happen all the time. I think I was quite young when I really got it that I'm here as a soul, and that soul is for infinity, you know, but this vehicle that I kind of put on this time round is one that, you know, goes off and on, and you get different vehicles each time, but the soul essence continues for infinity. And I can remember even as a little kid trying to work out infinity, you know, what is it? You know, is there a big brick wall? Oh, but what's on the other side of the brick wall? Like really trying to fathom what infinity is. And I don't think I've even still got a full handle on it, but I just know that as a soul, it's not just this time. And I kind of, and once again, this all comes back to the Mayan calendar as well as human design, both predicted in these times. Like in the Mayan calendar, we talked about from 1987 right the way through to 2012 was just 2012 is actually the midpoint of a 26-year from 1987 to 2012 was 26 years. And then there's a further 26 years after that, which is this frequency of time that's in the middle of a 26,000 year spin. So our solar system takes 26,000 years to get around the galaxy. And basically we're in this particular band where we have this photon band of light coming through. and really shifting things here, you know, for us and our solar system. And I kind of knew as a soul, I came here for this party, if that makes sense. You know, like I came here for this huge shifting time for humanity. And so even though I can get at times caught in the minutiae of it, you know, the day-to-day detail of what's going on, how it's affecting us, when I sit back in my back seat, I then see the incredibleness of the shift that we're in right now and how perfect it actually all is. And that's why I can let go of some of this, I call very negative, you know, this is happening to us, that's happening, and this will happen, and the government's going to do that, or the government's not going to, or whatever. Really is quite immaterial when we look at the soul journey as only a blink in the eye in that span of eternity. So why get so caught up in it all?
Well, there's nothing like contemplating eternity to put our problems in perspective, right? So interestingly, a couple of weeks back, I was interviewing Alia Bland, one of the founders of RCR, and she said something really interesting. She said that every day, at the end of the day, she likes to go out and just look up at the stars. And it sounded to me like that was her way of tuning in to a much bigger perspective. You know, it's so easy as a human to get wrapped up in our concerns, our daily focus, and to think that, you know, we're the most important thing in the universe. And then sometimes it's a real relief, isn't it, just to sit back and see that we're important. But when you look at it in the concept of, say, the universe or the stars, or you look at it in terms of eternity, then somehow it enables us to not take ourselves quite so seriously. What do you think?
Definitely. And yeah, I realize that, you know, sometimes when I do take myself seriously, that's when I'm not sitting back in my back seat. It's usually, you know, all to do with the fact that I'm sort of getting all worried about something that isn't even real.
So this is really interesting. I'm finding this fascinating, Christine, because, you know, first of all, two things. Number one, light is obviously really important to you. It's like I can see that your description of the Mayan calendar really described light, right? That you're talking about this time as a time of light, or a specific particular light. You know, when I heard the Mayan calendar stuff around about 2012, everyone was saying that was the end of the calendar. And have they created a new bit, or did they just not know what they were talking about?
Well, that was media sensationalism, as usual. The Mayans themselves, and I spent quite a bit of time with some of the priests and so forth in Mexico, and this is how I kind of got involved into it in quite a big way. In fact, we spent some time in the Yucatan as well as in Palenque, and studying it with a whole group of people from all around. And it was quite funny because we had these local Mayan priests came and saw all of us sitting at these tables with all of our papers and scribblings and everything about decoding and looking at everything. And they kind of looked at us quite mystically and sort of said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Don't you know that the calendar's in our body?" It's not on a piece of paper or not. And it was like, it was such a revelation of just realizing that we'd intellectualized it and turned it into this thing in our heads. But the reality is the calendar's moved around in our body forever. You know, we've got 13 tones that are in our major joints, and the 20 fingers and toes are all to do with the seals, and they all interlink constantly and move around. And so, yes, we have energies each day that can tell us what the energy of the day is, but also when we look at our birth energy, what we came here for, what our purpose is all about. And so that was the work that I used to do with the calendar, is really getting people to sink into their own frequency of what they were birthed into. And then, of course, once I came home and got introduced to human design, it just went, whoa, that's even a far more dynamic, not a lot more specific to our solar system, but as well as that, more importantly, to the I Ching, which is the codes of our DNA. And that was interesting because even my Mayan calendar, one of the Mayan calendar teacher priests, she was actually a shamanic journeyer, but she was also a university lecturer for working with the DNA. And at that particular time, we're studying the codes of our DNA and how if they take somebody through some kind of work, and she was experimenting with the Mayan calendar work, giving people their purpose codes, is that after 13 weeks, their DNA would shift. And she was doing a whole study on that. And it was like, wow, so that's very similar to what I'm looking at here with the human design, as we're looking at those I Ching codes that fit to the 64 codons of our DNA. And so all of that's kind of fascinates me. But once again, just to try and keep away from getting caught into my mind trying to study it all, but just living it in life. I think it's a big part.
So let's ground this conversation a little bit more in you. I mean, this is really interesting stuff, and I'm sure, like me, the listeners are fascinated by this. But if we just go back to what you said about you grew up in a business family, and it sounds very entrepreneurial. But did I also hear that you also have as sort of your family roots? Where do you come from in terms of how did your parents end up in New Zealand? What's the roots of your family story?
Well, that's massive. On my mum's side, her family were the captain of the ship for Samuel Marsden and his missionaries.
Wow.
So they were the first settlers that came here that set up a missionary station way up north. And in fact, one of the great aunts was the, in fact, it goes back 8 generations for me, 9 for my boys. We were there, and it was in 1814 we arrived. So that was a whole generation before the treaty. So we're tangata whenua. And we also were, because we weren't missionaries, in fact, the missionaries came to educate the so-called savages, we call it, which is very, you know, derogatory in these days, but that was the terminology then. And so they didn't educate our family. In fact, for 3 generations, the Hansen family were not educated at all, but they were the worker bees. So my great-great-great uncle, he was the one that actually supplied all of the food for the missionaries to survive there because he was a gardener. And that gardening trait goes all the way back through. I kind of think I missed those genes somehow, because even my boys have those genes, but I'm learning. We're getting there. And then on my dad's side is even more interesting, and we're now allowed to talk about it. It was actually secret squirrel stuff before he died. But he was born to 2 illegitimate parents. Which was just such a big shame in those days. In fact, my granddad was left on the doorstep of a Dunedin nursing home, and we think may have had something to do with Donald Sutherland, who was the discoverer of Milford Sound, or kind of the big guy dude for there. And so my family name was Sutherland. But yes, yeah, so very kind of short term, but all very Scottish. So 3 of my grandparents, grandparents were Scottish. So that real Presbyterian, hard work, kind of slightly dour, way of operating. But yeah, my dad, set up a business in Whakatane, and, as a panel beater originally, and then ended up with a big car business and employed quite a few people. And so, yeah, he lived it like 24/7. He was 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, just loved work and the community and doing things in the community. So I was very much brought up with, if it wasn't Rotary, we would have the Chamber of Commerce at our place, and my sister and I would take the plates of food around. You know, you've got to meet the mayor on a regular basis sort of thing. So, yeah, you kind of just brought up with this way of thinking as how I see being an advantage because Dad would come home and say, the bank manager's now, you know, causing me this issue. And so then he'd drive to Wellington and go and talk to the main dude down in Wellington, and he'd get whatever he wanted done. You know, he was one of those. and he'd do it his way, is kind of how we had as a family motto.
Yeah. Wow, what a blast from the past, as they say. I mean, I just feel like you dived in to so much of New Zealand history in maybe three or four sentences. It was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God.
My granddad was amazing in he collected so much of this information, and he did it way, way back in a time where his wife and him were school teachers up in very remote schools.
And is this your maternal granddad or your paternal?
Yes, my maternal, yeah. And he collected all of the family tree stuff by sending a letter to somebody. And that stamp was like came out of their budget as something they couldn't afford. But he would send these letters off and then get the information back. And they finally connected the whole family tree. And I can remember he had a whole room in the house when I was a kid that was full of all these papers of the family tree stuff. And then eventually one of the other Hansons took it on and kind of turned it into now we've got this enormous family tree, because they all had heaps of kids in those first few generations, you know, so there's lots of branches to the tree. And then we had a big family gathering. I think it was for the 150-year celebrations, and it was a bit frightening to, you know, see a whole room full of your ancestors, if you like, or the progeny of the ancestors in one big huge room. Yeah, so very interesting.
What was that like? I can't even imagine what that would be like.
At the time, kind of, I wasn't really that interested, but now in looking back, I am, especially after we did the journey away, came home and was just fascinated by that. I then read all of the materials and read all of Granddad's books and the things that he'd put together on it, and realized that I'm really proud of the grandmother in my line. She was written up by Samuel Marsden as a drunken, gun-running, wanton woman. I think she was obviously very, very colourful. And so, yes, definitely a long line of alcoholism was, you know, because that's all they had to trade in was alcohol. So you kind of get to see, oh, okay, that's how that can happen.
So it sounds like they were trading in guns as well, because that was another big trading item in that time.
Yeah, yes, and obviously she was good at that.
What was that description, that colourful description? I've got to hear that again.
Drunken, gun-run, wanton woman. She was obviously a bit naughty as well. So very, very colourful. And yes, and I do understand that the grandfather in my line, he actually ended up spending more time with the priest of the tribe that actually allowed them to stay on the marae in Northland. And the son ended up being educated at the school where this young man ended up getting educated in the whakapapa of the chief's family, and so was very literate in Māori as well as in English. And the chief complained a little that his son was learning all these Pākehā ways and he wasn't learning his own whakapapa.
So just to make sure I've understood you, Christine, I'm fascinated by this, because this goes to the roots of so much of what's happening today as well, doesn't it? That our ability to understand those early days. So have I understood you right that you say the local Māori chief, his son, was
being educated by the missionaries? You know, and the missionaries lived a little apart from the pā, where the Hansen family lived sort of near them, but were very much integrated within the tribe, because they needed that protection, I think, back in those days. I think it was this particular chief had got them to come so that he could win the wars, I would imagine, was the motive behind it. I don't know. That part of the history wasn't fully written up, but yeah.
That's very interesting, isn't it, that that there was this power dynamic as to who had the guns, right? So if they had someone that was trading in guns. So you said, so your family goes back to before the treaty. So your family were people of the land, as you said, the Tangata Whenua.
Yes. Yeah. So well, that's how we kind of look at it. I don't know whether Māoridom would adopt that at all, but, you know, we were here for quite a length of time, you know, before there was even the treaty.
And the treaty particularly, I think, refers to the tribe of Victoria as well. So there are, in fact, and maybe it's not the 40 treaty, maybe I'm thinking of the 1834. I must get my history on this. I'm struggling. I love history, and I've only been here for 3 years, so I'm catching up with hundreds of years of history here. But this is very, very interesting that in many ways to be thinking of your descendants as coming to New Zealand, wow, 1814.
Yes.
And being here for, you know, 26 years prior to the Waitangi Treaty, that's a very interesting moment in history, I think.
Yes, yeah, I was saying that they see that as a generation. And so there were, you know, people within the family had a better understanding of Te Reo because they were living with them. As I say, the missionaries really, apart from getting supplied by food, didn't have a lot to do with them. And the missionaries changed too. Like they had come for a few years and then they'd go again, and Samuel Marsden sort of had the station set up for them.
Judging by Samuel Marsden's description of your great, 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 how many times grandmother, the missionaries might have looked down on your family.
Definitely did, yes. You know, they were the captain of the ship that brought the supplies in and out to them. And then the captain actually left his main family here in New Zealand, and he kept going back to Sydney getting supplies and bringing them backwards and forwards. So, yeah, that was very... They were definitely put off to the side, is what we gathered.
I think you're the first person I've met since coming back to New Zealand who can trace back that far in terms of the first non-Māori person to track back right to those early days of settling. That just is so, wow, I just feel like I've dropped back, you know, 100 and whatever many years, 160 years, more than that, yeah. How many years is it to 1814? Gosh, I can't even, well, it must be 200, and it must be 210 years. It's a very simple sum.
Yes.
Wow, that's amazing. And your descendants, your ancestors, sorry, came from Scottish, but there's a very interesting and close link here with the Māori, right? They had to be really closely integrated with the Māori, and the Māori wanted them there too. That's a very interesting point.
Yes. So it was, once again, I don't know, because they hadn't been educated, they didn't write much of the history, although there's things written about them.
Yeah,
my grandfather did quite a lot of research on all of that and got the different information. There's some books available on the Hanson family. That, as I say, extended out to many of the initial families of the area, because they were where the missionaries came and went, and so they didn't really establish here the same as they did in some other countries. They tended to go back to Australia.
And, I mean, I'm afraid my love of history is taking over this interview. I'm sorry about that.
It is interesting. That's why, for me, having been brought up in Whakatane was such a strong Māori connection as well. Like, I can remember at school, it wasn't until I was a teenager in high school that I even realised there was a difference. And that happened because I went out with a Māori boy, and the Māori girls then wanted to beat me up. it was like, I was not meant to do that, apparently. And I was that naive, it just didn't occur to me that there was a difference.
And did you when you were growing up, were you very separate from the Maori children, or was
it? That's what I'm saying. Because they were all, you know, we went to school all together, we played in the street all together. And I think because of my mum's background of having been brought up in all these native schools, very remote schools, all throughout her childhood, she never saw anything different. So we weren't brought up with that kind of seeing that there's Māori and there's Pākehā or anything like that. It was just, and I just remember sitting in school, and we were very lucky in Whakatāne. We had this delightful guy that came and spoke of the Māori legends, and just being inspired by all these wonderful stories. And I can remember them talking about the Tūhoe up in the Uruweras and they're being children of the mist. And I don't know, something about me, you know, and I used to fantasize about the fact that I was born in the mist of the Uruweras, just as a child, you know, having that something, yeah, was always connected there. And then after having traveled all through the Americas and spending so much time working with the healing medicines of a lot of the indigenous people, because Sam and I were teaching massage most of the way through our journey. And so we would pick up on all these different medicinal ways that the local people used. And so when we came home, it was like, we need to actually learn about Māori's traditional medicine. And through lots of magic, once again, lots of magic ended up at a healer's gathering in Whakatāne one time when we were home visiting. And from there, you know, continued on, and that's how I got to meet Rose Petty, who also, from what I learned, is that Tūhoe have always followed the same star system, which is to do with Sirius, as what the Mayans and the Egyptians followed. And so Sirius is the main connection sun, and she celebrated the new year the same as the Mayans, which is the 26th of July.
Wow.
And, so that's the new year from the Mayan, and that's because Sirius was the central sun that they all. And so Tūhoe followed those same traditions. That was her. And so when we connected, it was like, wow, all of these interconnections. So we would go and gather in Waikere Moana each year, and, you know, until recently when she passed. So.
Well, now we're delving back into even further back in history, aren't we? Because it's like you're now talking about the connections between these ancient civilizations are popping up all over the place now, aren't they?
Yes. Well, once again, Rose always talked about Tūhoe were here from the beginning of time. They weren't to Waka Māori. They were already here as the peaceful people of the Uruweras, you know, literally. Yeah, and so the connection when Waka Māori arrived, that was one of the things I learned from the elders in the Wairaka Marae in Whakatāne, and this is why they laughed when I told them the story of how I'd call at the Bay of Plenty this bowl of abundance. And they said, well, actually, on the Matatua canoe when it came in, they were holding the blueprints for the new time. And that what was actually seated in the Matatua canoe with Whakatāne's heads was the where the gateway into the area, and then Waikere Moana was the whare, and that whole piece of land actually holds the blueprint and the energy for the new time. So, yeah, I'm still interested to see how that will unfold.
And some listeners might be a little bit confused at hearing that you're saying there are people here before the Māori, right?
Oh, I wouldn't have thought that most people know that. But anyway, we were even taught it in school. They were called, there was Māori Ori, but apparently because they're H people, and that's a bit debatable, they were kind of brushed off as being real savages, which is just completely untrue. We know that there was Waitaha, Māori Ori, there was a number of tribal people that were here, and they were actually peaceful people. Don't think they actually resorted to cannibalism, to be honest, but that we don't know. We weren't here in that time. So what we were brought up in school, the school history has been kind of flavoured a little. Of course, it's now very pertinent to be flavoured that way because the Treaty of Waitangi settlements, you know, might not go ahead if there'd been people here beforehand that Waka Māori kind of decimated. But we won't go there.
It is very interesting. I'm equally interested by your description, Christine, just from a societal point of view, really. I'm equally interested that many of the divisions that exist between Māori and Pākehā seems to have been generated in the last 20 or 30 years, that I've had many, many people talk of your generation, my generation too, by the way. Many people talk of this togetherness, of this sameness, not sameness because we're the same, but people just accepted as they were growing up in school that we're integrated. And that much of this division seems to have been instilled or created by educationalists, historians, politicians. I don't know what you think about any of that, but that's that. I've heard this story too many times already. I've only been here 3 years. I've heard too many stories of people growing up where there was no division.
Yes, exactly. And I think a little bit differently in, you know, like parts of the South Island, for instance, there weren't so many Māori there. I know my husband was brought up on the North Shore of Auckland, and in where he was brought up, there weren't many Māori. And so he had a different upbringing from that, where if you've been brought up regionally in New Zealand, I mean, yeah, I don't think it was such a difference. Mm. Yeah, I do understand that, you know, as I say, there's just a different belief system if you start to talk to people who are from Waitaha to Hui descent. Moriori, you know, based in the Chatham Islands, but they were also here in New Zealand, not just the Chatham Islands. So, yeah. And when you look at their, we spent some time and went to Chatham's, and their beautiful carvings and the intricate work that they had, they were not savages. I'm sorry. You know, they were a very advanced tribal when you look at the beauty of their art. There's some very significant work done, you know, way before Waka Māori came. Yeah. But as I said, I don't want to get into that debate because it's really not my area of expertise. It's just something that I know.
No, but it is interesting. I mean, everyone's entitled to tell their story and everyone's entitled to their opinion, in my view. So I think it's kind of interesting. And I'm just thinking now, Christine, well, I've been very excited by the history. I'm wondering, what has been the most stressful times for you in your amazingly colourful life, Christine? And what helps you the most? How do you manage to deal with stress or trauma? What have you found to be the most useful for you?
I think I'm a little bit of a Pollyanna, is a part of it. And that comes about in my design. I hold in my design Gate 25, and Gate 25 is about universal love. It's about this innocence of life that just loves life as it is. And I also, in one of the other major gates in my son, is to do with joy. And so I've always had a bit of a tendency to go, well, I can remember when I first got pregnant, it was like, oh my gosh, I'm now not going to travel right now. You know, I'm going to do it when I'm 18. You know, and that was kind of how I, within myself, I had it all worked out. Well, by the time I'm 18, I'll have the money to do it in style. I'll be able to go and stay in the Ritz at that age, where if I do it, you know, now I'm backpacking and I can't afford it. So I sort of was able to work it all out and kind of figured that that was, you know, what I was there to do. And so some people may have seen that as a negative, stressful time, but actually it wasn't. It was a part of where I learned to be super self-reliant. you know, I ended up very soon on, I did get married, but that didn't sort of work out. And so I was on my own for quite some time with the boys. But I was very lucky because I had this extended family, his family, who were Māori, as well as my family, just loved having the boys on a regular basis. So even though I was bringing them up, I would often have the holidays, school holiday time and things like that, where the boys would be just gone and I'd get to do my own thing through that time. But I also, started up my own businesses. In fact, one of the first businesses I had was to do with selling personal development motivational material, all based on goal setting and stuff. And I laugh about that now. It's like goal setting. Oh, my God, that mind-orientated, I'm going to achieve this kind of stuff, which is completely against where I'm at now. But I know that those years of listening to that material over and over and over again, looking at always the positive side of things, certainly helped. You know, it's been a huge part of who I am. And then I became a business consultant. We moved to Auckland so the boys can go to Auckland Grammar. And I became a business consultant with no qualifications whatsoever. But I ended up doing team building type work for companies. And I did it in a really kind of weird way because I really, having been a person not that into sports or athletic type things, I thought the whole idea of a team building thing where you had to use your athletic prowess to deal with being in a team was horrific for people, like, especially if they were like me. It's how are you ever going to become the leader if you are kind of a bit useless at that? So I used to devise all sorts of other types of exercises, like it would be a cooking competition or we'd do all these sorts of things, we'd like MasterChef style, and put people into teams. And then I'd do this weird thing. All of a sudden there's a departmental shift and these people are moving out of that team and they're going into this team, but the meals were already planned and everybody get really upset. And it's like, yeah, well, that's what you do to a team when you change them around. And then I'd get them to do jigsaw puzzles. That was another one, these big kids kind of jigsaw puzzles. And I'd put all of the pieces, there'd be three different puzzles and all of the pieces in the middle. And of course they'd go and grab as many pieces that they could. And then it was learning that actually nobody's going to win this game until you share. Just stuff like that, you know. And it was all, I don't know, just things that I came up with that I felt, you know, like I'd look at the company and I'd interview them all and kind of get to see where their problems were in people. Like, I've always been fascinated by what makes people tick. So when I heard what you were doing, it's like, okay, man after my own heart. Yeah, and so that's sort of, I've always just studied life, I suppose, by watching others. And so, yes, that was one of my stress points was, you know, trying to make ends meet as a solo mum. But some what I learned quite early on was that I had to stop worrying about the 20th because I'd seemed to got through 4 years of 20ths already. And so why worry about it? You know, it just really is not helping at all by worrying about it. So those sorts of things I would kind of just give myself, oh, yeah, you've got through that, so you can get through something else. And the same with all, probably, you know, the biggest stress I've had recently has been the whole shift of what's happened through COVID. Because my life has now changed to being a little bit more sedentary and not so much on the move. And, yeah, I feel like at the moment there's not, I sort of describe it in human design terms, is that my sacral's not completely turned on by what's happening right now. I can't explain it more than that. It's just, you know, yes, most days things are pretty good. I love working with my clients with Bioptron because it's helping them with their health. I love doing, because I'm an analyst for human design. So when I sit down with somebody and do the analysis of who they are and then share it with them on a Zoom call, it's just like, wow, that's magic. But I'd love more of it to be happening. You know, it's being in one place is a little bit harder to bump into people like I used to. So through these stressful times, just to answer your question now properly, is that I tend to focus more in on the positive. I find our national media and even the other, I call it the other alternative media, sometimes both can be equally as negative. And I'm just really not interested. Don't need to delve into all of the what could go wrongs. I prefer to just focus in on what could go right and look at that. So I suppose in the short answer, that's kind of how I focus in on that. And I know that's annoying for some people.
Well, Christine, I feel likewise, just as you said, you felt that you and I were kindred spirits on some levels. I feel very much like that with you in terms of the diet of negativity or doom scrolling or diving down painful truth rabbit holes. It's a real danger for our spirit, for our health, for our well-being. We have to be very protective now, don't we? Especially the people that are fighting for truth and change that is healthy for humanity. I feel like I woke up and I thought I'd entered into a 200-meter sprint, and I find myself on my third 26-mile marathon without any break between the first and the second, or the second and the third. And I'm having to learn, personally, I'm having to learn to measure and pace and to protect and to look after myself. And that's what I'm encouraging the listeners to do, actually, more and more. And one of the ways we protect ourselves, which I think you've just described so beautifully, Christine, is focusing on what the positive is, not diving down the very easy to dive down pathways of despair and doom. And yes, there are terrible things going on, I'm sure. But at the same time, I know there always have been. And I know it's been tough for us, but, you know, previous generations had to put up with a lot of stuff as well. You know, we had world wars, we've had plagues, we've had the history of humanity as a history of a complete fustercluck, if I could use that slightly altered word. But we're being challenged, aren't we, to deepen and to understand our purpose and to be in control of where we go with our attention.
Yes. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, that's one of the things I can remember even in the team building exercise I used to do. I used to get people to stand up on a stool and for them to spout out what their strengths were. And it was so interesting how often they would immediately go to what their weaknesses were. And I go, no, we're not going there. You spend enough time there. We're now looking at what your strengths are. And boy, it's a hard thing for Kiwis to do, is to stand up and say, what am I good at? And be able to really put it across in a presentation as such. And I said, well, you know, how are you going to then manage people where you can't focus in on your own strengths? How are you going to focus in on theirs? You're going to spend all your time looking at what's wrong with them because that's what you do to yourself. And so that's kind of how I would turn it around. And I think that's what's also happening right now, is that we can spend too much time, I say, picking at our wee sores. You know I've got some. I'm certainly not perfect, but I'm actually perfect as I am. Because at this age now, I'm not really that interested in changing many of those things anymore. You know I've now lived 67 years with those sores and they've kind of got me by anyway, you know, so why keep on digging?
So what would you say to the 27-year-old who might be listening to the radio about managing their stress and trauma? Because I get the age thing, I totally get it, and how in some ways the delight of getting older, and I am exactly the same age as you, by the way, and I feel so liberated by getting old. I find it's a blessing to get old. But at the same time, I'm wondering what you would say to a young 27-year-old, you know, with your insights of what you've gained about managing stress and trauma.
Is finding the joy. We've got, every day we've got to find what gives us joy. And there will be things in your life that is shit, you know, like, I mean, trying to balance the grocery, you know, I used to, and I still hate going to supermarkets for that reason, because it was always such a stress to make sure I had enough for what I needed. You know, I can remember that quite distinctly. But it was like, find the joy there as well. You know, is there something that kind of lit you up? Like, just the other day I went into this gorgeous little organic shop and they had this cauliflower that was like a piece of art. It was just beautiful how the cauliflower somehow had formed. I don't know. It's finding something in there that can be joyful in it as well. And sometimes it's also the bumping into somebody that you've smiled at, that you have a conversation with. Lots of those sorts of things. And I know that's what, when we were traveling, because we chose not to, we kind of worked it out that we equally, you had to work to be able to pay for things, right? So it was like you had to really decide what you were going to pay for, because otherwise it would just mean more work and we'd be back onto the rat wheel again if we continued to do that. And so I can remember we, you know, decided not to have a lot of things. And I can remember coming back to New Zealand at one point and going out for dinner and being a bit horrified at the price of wine and the meals on the table, because, you know, we were used to being in Latin America where it cost you a couple of dollars for a meal at the little local, you know, shop under the house kind of thing. And these people saying, oh, you've got really tight. And it was like, actually, no, we've just choose not to go spending our money on that, because what it's going to mean is that we're going to have to work more to do that. And actually, we're enjoying our life so much, not working, working, working all the time. And okay, we were lucky, you know, we managed to earn really good money in the short periods of time. Like, we were teaching massage and we were also building massage tables. That was hilarious. In this motorhome, we would build these massage tables. So 700 massage tables total is what we believe over the 14 years we roughly built. And we'd sell those but we would end up being, you know, we would be dealing with the hotel owner and be taken home to their beautiful luxurious homes with all their maids. And then we'd also be taken home with the local lady that was doing massage in the hotel and to her very simple little adobe, you know, cottage, and be mixing in these completely different ways and have these incredible experiences. But, yeah, weren't spending a whole lot of money on things. You didn't, and you didn't have room for any more things anyway, which is great. It was one of our big dilemmas when we went to buy a property. We had to get more stuff because we had no furniture. Yeah. So, you know, those sorts of things, you just went through life making it more simple.
Beautiful. Well, Christine, I feel like we've touched on at least 20 conversations that I would love to continue to have with you. I feel like we've had a whirlwind tour of your really rather wonderful life. But more importantly, I hope the listeners are getting a sense of your just sheer joy and love of life. And it's really lovely. I think where you've moved to now, the local community are very lucky to have you there. I think you'll bring a lot of joy and light and positivity to the people around you. So I think they're very lucky to have you, Christine. We've run out of time. We're going to take a break. I know. It feels like 5 minutes, but we're going to take a break, and then I'm going to ask you to come and play some music. So, Christine, thank you so much for sharing your life and sitting in the psychotherapist chair.
Thank you. In fact, I've enjoyed the chat.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.